Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org. Hi, this is Nan Evans with Nature Now, and we are live today. We're actually alive all the time, but we are live on the radio today. And I want to tell you who's in the studio with me. Of course, Nora Petrich, our spectacular sound engineer, is on the board.
With whom we would be nothing.
Right. And the voice you've just been hearing is Debron Kelso. Both Debron and my voices could be really familiar to those of you who listen a lot. And we have a new voice, Jackie Canterbury. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Hello. Good morning.
And we'll talk more with Jackie later because she's just bringing some exciting things to us. So, first of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. It's so important to us to know that there are people in our community who really like our show. And I want to thank all of you folks out there who have made donations to date. We're going to talk a lot about the show today and why we're so excited about it. And what we hope the show through KPTZ brings to our community. And the first thing I was thinking about is we bring both the familiar, because we focus on the world around us, the natural world around us, and we bring bits of the unknown. Now, very definitely in the unknown category are the mystery sounds. Almost every program has a mystery sound. And I want to ask Debron, who's been doing this since the station began.
Since the very beginning.
So that would have been 12 years ago last week.
Yes, that's amazing.
It is amazing.
Congratulations.
I know. I never thought I'd be doing it this long. But I continue to love it and learn from it. So
Debron, you've been doing mystery sounds a long time. Why do you like them?
Well, I love the mystery sound because we as human beings are so visual. We're always, you know, gathering information through our eyes. But a lot of things in the natural world, you cannot see initially. You have to hear them first. And Jackie is a fellow bird lover, and she just has been teaching a class, Birding by Ear. I went last week, and it was really great. And you have to tune in by ear because a lot of those birds are so skulky that you will never get a visual. And a lot of things are like that in the natural world. So I figure that the more senses that you have open to gathering information, the better.
Well, and we try to not just do birds because it's really fun to think about other sources of sound. I remember one program I did on volcanoes and finding that they had done recordings in Hawaii using ultrasound, which it was sort of like ultra vision, ultra red, or whatever, and didn't, of course, expect anyone to recognize that. So our sounds actually go from the real brain twisters to the things you can hear popping outside your door in the morning.
Yeah, and we try to tailor them to what, as Nature Now, to what you might be hearing right now, unless it's something truly extraordinary that we've stumbled across that we can't resist putting in.
As you can tell, we do have a fun time building these programs and putting them together. So let's hear one of those mystery sounds. And this is one from...
It's a show that I did with Richard Lewis, who's a really great entomologist, and he's been such a joy for me because insects are so important, and not that many people know that much about them.
Right. And sort of a teaser for the listeners, in this clip, you will find the answer to the question, what do grasshoppers and cellos have in common?
And that sound is the sound of a grasshopper. A contrast of the two sounds that they most commonly make. The first, the sound of their back legs rubbing, and the second, the sound of their wings snapping. Would you like to tell us a bit more about those sounds, Richard?
Yeah, grasshoppers are amazing in that they do make a lot of noise. Some insects really don't have any kind of noise-making devices, but grasshoppers have, they use their hind legs, which have a bunch of little bumps or ridges on them, and they rub it rapidly against their wing cover. It's called stridulation, and that's how they make a call or a courtship call.
When I was reading a little bit about it, they were describing it like a bow, like a musician plays their cello with the bow, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah, they actually, if you with all the technology today on the internet, if you look up stridulation, you'll see some really cool video of how their legs are rubbing against the wing covers, and it is a lot like a bow on a violin. The other sound that they make is during flight, and they snap their wings out, and it creates kind of a popping or a snapping sound. And this is kind of has a dual purpose. It does also attract other grasshoppers around, and they use it to kind of impress the females before they start stridulating to try and court them in. But it's also a defense mechanism. It's kind of this loud cracking noise, and if they feel threatened or if there's predators in the area, sometimes they'll pop like that to try and drive off something that they're not comfortable with.
Huh, that's cool. And listening to those online too, some of them can be really loud. Will a grasshopper do both types of calls? Will every species do different types of calls?
There are different calls for different species, but it's generally the adult male that's making the noises. So they need the wing cover in order to make the noise, and only the adult form has wings. So juvenile grasshoppers aren't able to make the stridulation that the adults are able to do. And as a call for courtship or trying to pull in the females, it's typically only the males that are making that type of a noise.
Well, very interesting.
Wasn't that fun? Let's hear another mystery sound. And this was another one from one of Debron's interviews. So, Debron, do you want to talk about it?
Yes. It's one of my favorite interviewees. It's Dr. Fred Sharp. And you can ask him about anything. And he's just amazing. He's primarily a whale biologist, and he's up in Alaska right now studying humpback whales. But he's passionate about prairies, and he's passionate about all sorts of things in the natural world, birds. But anyway, in this particular interview, we were asking him about dune restoration. And we were out at Fort Worden State Park, where various partners have been instrumental in helping with the dune restoration in that area. So there was a mystery sound involved in this dune show. We want to hear that mystery sound again. And it's the sound of a burrowing owl. And we chose the variant that you hear that rattling call. And it's apparently, and I had no idea that they did this. I got this recording from the Cornell Ornithology Lab, which has fabulous recordings of all different types of calls of different species. And this one they described as the rattling call. And apparently burrowing owls make the sound to ward off predators because they often share the habitat with rattlesnakes. So they make this rattling call so that predators won't go into their burrows thinking that it's a rattlesnake. So anyway, it is genius. But you have a great story about burrowing owls from this very area, don't you, Fred?
Yeah, it was probably 20 years ago, and it was in fall migration, and I was out here bird watching, and lo and behold, it looked like a coyote den, that there was a burrowing owl popped up out of it. And they're so cool. They have those long legs, and they kind of stand upright, and those luminous yellow eyes, and all those little bows and bobs and little cluckings and little rattling sounds that they make. And it was like, man, that's fantastic to see them in this habitat. And You know, we don't get them much here these days, but we know from the old records of the early naturalists that the brewing owls, they used to nest on islands in Grays Harbor. There's evidence they may have nested out on the Quileute Prairie and possibly could have extended their range, their breeding range, over in this area too. So it's lovely to have them come through, and it's precisely these types of restoration programs that increase habitat quality that one day we may have their little cluckings and rattles breeding back in this wonderful habitat.
We can hope for that. As an aside, Meg and I just came back from Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, and we saw burrowing owls on a hillock and doing the little bobbing, so they were probably defending a nest, and I was just over the moon to see them. They're just so darling, and we hope that they come back to this area again.
And if any of you don't have a visual image of a burrowing owl, please Google it. They are just spectacular. They stand up on those legs and they stand tall and they go, "Here I am." But you have to look really close because I'm not going to be very visible for very long. I would love to have them back in this place. But I think probably more eastern Washington, perhaps.
Yes. And there's a very famous photographer, similar to Thomas Mengelson, who we'll talk about later, Michael Forsberg, who one of the most celebrated photographs of that owl was produced by him.
Oh,
and that
I'll
was in Nebraska. Michael Forsberg.
Yeah,
yeah, okay. He has a website, and it's just phenomenal.
So I need to share, too, one of the great things about Nature Now is we really do invite listeners to connect with us, to share ideas, to ask questions, or just to chatter. So I want to share that you can always get to us on our email address, which is naturenow, one word, @kptz.org. Again, naturenow@kptz.org. Well, now let's go on to sort of a new perspective. We have new voices on Nature Now. We have two people in the room. We have Jackie Canterbury and Kate Nichols just joined us. Let's start with a question for both Jackie and Kate. Why are you interested in being a Nature Now host, and what do you hope to bring to the program and to our community of listeners?
I guess I'll go first. I'm Kate Nichols, and I've always been interested in nature. I camped out as a child forever and explored nature, and now I get a chance to have taken some classes here as far as a beach naturalist and seen all the amazing seaweed, some of the animals in the mountains, and it's been quite an experience, and I'd like to share it with the audience. Also, it's a lot easier to ask someone to be on the radio than to go for a cup of coffee when I want more information about.
Good idea.
Yeah, you know, I always sort of hated the cold call, but I have really enjoyed it on Nature Now because it's part of what you often have to do. It has become something I really enjoy because you can reach out and talk to somebody that you might not have crossed paths with and ask questions.
Well, and it gives you a really good excuse, like Kate said, to say, you know, I would really like to know more about soils. Who can I call about soils?
Exactly.
And so for me, it's always something that I want to know about, too. And I figure that the rest of the radio audience would also like to learn alongside me.
Yeah, because part of the fun thing, too, is thinking about, well, what questions am I interested in? And what questions might listeners to be interested in? I get a great joy out of just pondering that. So Jackie, what about you?
I've just been contemplating. And I think age brings a lot of wisdom. And I think I have a lot stored up here. And as a field biologist and as a college prof, so I think I'd like to share that with people, because aging can be difficult. But if you share your knowledge with people and bring people out and discuss their own experiences, I think it really makes a difference in people's lives. And I also think we live in such a vibrant community who have so many interests in terms of, you know, you talked about the people that you get, you know, to answer the questions. Nan, you've talked about that too, the whale researcher. So there's so much to offer here and so much to give. And then also I just have a passion for birds, as many of you know, and also for the beauty of our environment.
It's all just kind of wonderful things that just kind of go to my heart, too.
When Jackie was talking about age, I have to mention that a couple of months ago, I did an interview with Claire Manis Hattler about the Manis mastodon, and she is 92 years old, and she was such an inspiration for me.
Yes.
I mean, she's just really vibrant and sharp as a tack and passionate about what she found, you know, 50 years ago, but also passionate about what's happening in the natural world today. So I just loved interviewing her and getting an excuse to speak with her.
And that's a really good point as far as bringing those people into the fold that have so much knowledge. You know, I had a great aunt, and she gave me so much, and I think a lot of it was her knowledge. And so I have a keen respect for elderly people and what they hold, and what I'd like to do is bring them into the fold. I commend you for doing that and interview those people, because I think it's so critical to do.
Yeah, and I also want to add, there's the other end of the age spectrum.
There is.
The youth.
Younger.
And
yes.
I am hoping
wonderful
this summer to be able to interview a high school senior. She will graduate from Port Townsend High School very soon now. And she's been doing a project down on Chimicum Ridge. And I just really am looking forward to getting her involvement and to looking at questions through the eyes of someone of a younger generation. I've done that a couple of times, particularly with young folks who have been volunteering for the Marine Science Center, and it's always fun to open ourselves to the
diversity of
the
our community.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I want to make another just comment about Nature Now, building off of Jackie's comment about diversity. We sort of define our scope as the natural history of our region. And our definition of region is broad.
Yes.
And kind of loose.
Yes.
And we do everything from geology and oceanography and weather to birds to mammals to invertebrates to soil to, oh, we did one once on tardigrades.
You know? Good.
That's a yeah, so we can wonder on in a broad range of topics. And we sort of figure even things like tides that are experienced locally but are really caused in a much, much bigger sphere, we can talk about tides.
A greater scale.
And we can talk about conservation. And mm-hmm. it's just fun to be able to explore that breadth. And for instance, for me, I have done a couple of geology shows. I'm not a geologist by any scope of the imagination. It's so much personal fun just to talk to these people and learn what they have to know. And
yes, and then share that with the community.
And there have been a couple of times when graduate school training was in oceanography, but that was like decades ago, and I never really practiced as a scientist. But I interviewed a chemical oceanographer a few years ago, and it was such fun for me to go, I know a little bit of this. Can I even understand what this guy is now doing? Because his research questions are so much further advanced because of the technical advances than, you know, we did when I was learning oceanography. So it runs that whole spectrum, which I love.
No, I agree. Definitely.
Me too. Yep.
Jackie has already done one program. It aired a couple of weeks ago. And Jackie, do you want to introduce that program and then kind of set the scene for our next sound clip that you had in that program? Can you do that?
I can. And, you know, I can sort of take off on what you just said, and that is that, you know, this program was in Nebraska, and it was on sandhill cranes, and Tom Mangelson. Tom Mangelson is a very renowned wildlife photographer, not from the Pacific Northwest. The cranes are, there were just two cranes, so I'm on a group, a chat group with people that are neurotic birders. Why do I say that?
Yeah.
But so the chat says that there basically are two sandhill cranes, we think, one greater and one lesser, down on Center Road.
Oh, yeah, because they often come down.
Actually, can I interject to say that my friend Meg, we did a recording out in the field yesterday, and she's my field recorder, and she lives down in Quilcene, and that was her main aim, is to go look for them because they had been seen
for actually a week. And so I'm going to, after this show, I am going to go down there. But, you know,
cool.
Of course, because I'm neurotic. So, but, sandhill cranes did breed here, okay, historically. And there's lesser, greater, and then there's also the Canadian. And so as a result, I hoped to bring together the idea that though, you know, I was on the Platte to do the interview, that basically these cranes were once here and still are in small numbers. And so this is a migratory group that's coming through. But, you know, being the greater and the lesser, I'm not sure that they didn't get a little blown off because they're supposed to be at the bottleneck on the Platte River in Nebraska. So we'll see what they are.
Let's hear that.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit what it's like to photograph cranes?
Well, I've taken literally millions of pictures of cranes over the years, mostly with my mentor, Paul Johnsgaard, who's one of the most well-known ornithologists. He's written 105 books. He just passed away about a year and a half ago. And he taught me a lot about cranes, and we've done a book on cranes together, as well as waterfowl and Yellowstone, etc. But with Paul as my guiding light, he really taught me much about cranes. And but just growing up and watching them, you know, as a field observer, they're magical in their behavior. They dance. They meet. You know, also, can you hear them just coming up now? Yeah, they're coming. They're just lifting off from their marshing area to go to the river right now. So their sounds are ancient, and their behavior is ancient, and they mate for life, and they're long-lived, and they have this incredible dance on their way north, and anytime when they feel a little bit anxious, or maybe during the mating season they dance more. But they pair up here and further south, and they have their subadult chicks with them, showing them the way to, you know, way south and way north back to their nesting grounds, and then they kick the young ones out, and they lay eggs and continue their life. But their sound and everything is very heartwarming to me. And just watching them right now, with all their incredible flight patterns and sun setting and beautiful skies, it's just very special, and I wish you could all be here.
That was very nice.
So we talked a bit about how broad our programs are in terms of what kinds of things we talk about. We also can get very thought-provoking, because the whole subject of conservation and nature,
yes,
has a really strong, I'm learning to say this, philosophical component. And just last spring, I was actually really blessed to be able to do a couple of interviews with Kathleen Dean Moore, who is a philosopher, an environmental writer, an advocate. And she and I talked a lot about some of the really critically important questions that go really deep into how we operate as individuals in the human world. So this first clip I want to share with you is from a program called Take Heart. And it's about responses to what we sometimes see as an environmental degradation or harm. And it's about how do we think about outrage and anger. So let's hear that clip.
You talk a bit in your book, Take Heart, about how we handle outrage. I mean, I could be outraged at those palm oil plantations. And yet I know, as much as I try, I use products that have palm oil in them. And I think about salmon, and I enjoy salmon. I try to always buy it direct from the fisherman that has been in Alaska. So some of that outrage might be directed at myself, but also some of it's kind of directed at that larger corporate entity, or that larger corporate greed, or the larger societal greed that I know I'm a part of. But how do you think about that? How do you wander your way philosophically through that dilemma?
Well, let me start out with a parenthetical point, is that if you do direct the anger at yourself, that is exactly what big oil wants you to do. These multi-million dollar campaigns to make you think that you are responsible, even to make you think that it's a consumer-driven thing.
Right, and they're doing the best thing, and they're, yeah.
Yeah, even as they are outsourcing their guilt on you. I confess that people often, in fact, I should say every time I give a talk, somebody is going to criticize me for being so angry. Look at what I'm angry at. Here we have corporations who are gouging the earth and gouging the people, and in the process creating the greatest violation of human rights this world has ever seen. I don't think that's an overstatement. You look at the facts. By 2050, 1 billion people, one out of every people on earth, will be driven from their homes by flood and drought and starvation. Why? So that some people can get extraordinarily rich. And that children are sickened by particle pollution and carcinogens in the air, and aquifers are poisoned by fracking and in injecting chemicals that are usually used to kill insects or clean toilet bowls or strip paint or polish brass. All these chemicals, the chemicals we use to preserve corpses and commit murder, arsenic, are being injected into our aquifers. And I'm not supposed to be angry about that. People say, you know, you should be more understanding, you should be more empathetic. These oil barons are caught in the system and they're just doing their job. Well, let me point out that refusing to participate in wrongdoing on a cosmic scale is an option open even to people who are wearing gold cufflinks. That each one of us can say, this is wrong and I won't participate. And then you and I, we, and the people who are listening can say something even better. We can say, this is wrong. This is wrong, and I won't allow it.
Thanks and happy trails.
That's the Woody Woodpecker song. He's a pecking it all day long. He pecks a few holes in a tree to see if a redwood's really red.
And it's nothing to him on the tiniest whim to peck a few holes in your head.
That's the Woody Woodpecker's tune. Makes the other woodpeckers swoon. Though it doesn't make sense to the dull and the dense, all the lady woodpeckers long for. That's the Woody Woodpecker's song.
That's the Woody Woodpecker's song. I look at the hoo-hoo. He's a pecking it all day long.
He pecks a few holes in a tree to see if a redwood's really red.